The following talk is from the 2014 Fall Retreat from the Insight Meditation Community of Washington at Pearlstone Retreat Center in Reisterstown, Maryland.
This is a popular wisdom folktale as told by David Franco from Turkey. One day Solomon decided to humble Benai ben Jehoiada, his most trusted minister. He said to him, "Benaiah, there is a certain ring I want you to bring to me. I wish to wear it for Sukkot, which gives you 6 months to find it. If it exists anywhere on earth, Your Majesty, I will find it and bring it to you. But what makes the ring so special?" "It has magic powers," answered the king. "If a happy man looks at it, he becomes sad. And if a sad man looks at it, he becomes happy." Solomon knew that no such ring existed in the world, but he wished to give his minister a little taste of humility. Spring passed and then summer, and still Benaiah had no idea where he could find the ring. On the night before Sukkot, he decided to take a walk in one of the poorest quarters of Jerusalem. He passed by a merchant who had begun to set out the day's wares on a shabby carpet. "Have you by any chance heard of a magic ring that makes the happy wearer forget his joy and the broken-hearted wearer forget his sorrows?" asked Benaiah. He watched the grandfather take a plain gold ring from his carpet and engrave something on it. When Benaiah read the words on the ring, his face broke out in a wide smile. That night, the entire city welcomed the holiday of Sukkot with great festivity. "Well, my friend," said Solomon, "have you found what I sent you after?" All the ministers laughed, and Solomon himself smiled. And to everyone's surprise, Benaiah held up a small gold ring and declared, "Here it is, Your Majesty." As soon as Solomon read the inscription, the smile vanished from his face. The jeweler had written three Hebrew letters on the gold band: Gimel, Zayin, Yud, which began the words, "Gam ze yachavor," "This too shall pass." At that moment, Solomon realized that all his wisdom and fabulous wealth and tremendous power would be fleeting things, and one day he'd be nothing but dust. Rinpoche spoke in his talk of coming in the presence. Last night, among many things, Tara spoke about how to be with and how to transform fear. And tonight, I'd like to talk about cultivating awareness of the three characteristics of reality and how remembering these three characteristics can lead you to freedom, to true freedom. So here we are, 3 days in. We've all been paying our dues so far. I imagine you've gotten quite intimate with your depletion and your exhaustion. I've seen, the few moments I've looked, a fair bit of whiplash meditation happening. If you're not familiar with that. I imagine also you're starting to get familiar with the top 10 stories that are just kind of repeating themselves. And no matter where you think you are in the process, no matter how much you might judge yourself for not being deep enough or whatever it may be, you've stayed. And you've come back again and again and again. And you cannot measure the impact of your practice to this point. To me, this is a magical time, this stage of the retreat. Because this is the time when we're heading into the belly of the retreat. You have perhaps a little more rest, a little more concentration. You're getting familiar with the routines of the day, the routines of the treat, which can allow you to more and more just relax back into trusting the process, being present to what naturally unfolds in your experience. We've been in these early days in the process of gathering attention, sort of a willful practice, perhaps, of just coming back again and again, recognizing what's here, examining what it means to be with it. So I'd like to talk tonight a little bit about how you can use this attention that you have built up over these days. I'd like to lead some inquiries into the characteristic of anicca, of impermanence, the characteristic of dukkha, of the stress or dissatisfaction or unsteadiness that can arise at times, and some inquiries into the characteristic of anatta, or not self. What does that mean? How can we find ways to touch into that? So the title of this talk is Contemplating the Three Characteristics of Reality. I actually like this title better, Sacred Fertilizer Part 3. We're going to beat that one to death. So a man enters a monastery and he meets with the head abbot, who is this wise, all-seeing man. And he says, if I do all the practices that you've outlined for me, how long will it take me to get liberated? The abbot kind of closed his eyes, opened his eyes again. He looked at him, carefully looked in his eyes. He said, 10 years. The man said, What if I just double down on everything? What if I just take your instructions and I double everything? How long will that take? The abbot looked at him, looked in his eyes, said, 20 years. When I got into yoga many, many years ago, decades ago, so many people didn't even know what the word meant. When I said I do yoga, many people thought I was saying yogurt. So we'd have a conversation about that. But now, of course, if you say I do yoga, people say, oh, well, what kind? Bikram, Iyengar, Kripalu, Integral? And we have all these distinctions in yoga practice. In that same way, meditation is making its way into our culture. And we have more and more of a nuanced understanding of different techniques and different traditions and how they can be of support for us. There are practices that draw on rigor and concentration and focus. There are practices and traditions that embrace a quality of surrender, a quality of allowing, and a quality of letting go. And chances are you've experimented with both sides of that equation of application and focus and rigor, other times just letting be. One tradition says things like, meditate like your hair is on fire. Rigor. Another tradition says, enlightenment is only possible through deep relaxation and letting go. How do we reconcile these two? The Buddha's journey also included all kinds of different practices. When he started his journey, he engaged into rigorous practices, into the yoga of that day, which is through austerities, through denying the body food, denying the body clothing, doing extreme postures. And those practices, the rigorous practices, they create sort of a transcendent experience. But the Buddha realized that while they were transcendent, they weren't liberating. And he continued to explore. And out of that came this articulation of the middle way, of the place that is not too tight and not too loose. focus and concentration are tremendous tools. Taking the time to develop one-pointed awareness of the awareness of what is happening as it's happening will serve you greatly. And yet, just developing concentration and focus perhaps is not complete. I've met some very concentrated people who are miserable. So what's missing in that equation? And there's something here about mindfulness, about cultivating a quality of non-judging awareness. The sense of what Rinpoche mentioned at the end of his talk, this what it means to be the witness of everything. So I'd like to lead a few inquiries, a few short meditations during this talk, just as a way to kind of touch in. It's one thing to speak about these things, it's another to sense it on the inside. So you might, just for a moment, to close your eyes, maybe just for a few minutes. And you might bring your attention into your hands. Just let your awareness flood into the thumbs and the fingers. And in your own way, just make contact with the aliveness of here and now in the form of the hands. And sense what it's like just simply to notice moment to moment to moment awareness of the direct experience of the vibration, the pulse, the tingling, the warmth. And you may sense in just a few moments of directing your awareness through concentration, a quality of calming, a quality of presence, a quality of sustained attention, perhaps. And you might just ask, what is it that feels these sensations? And relax into that question. Can you sense the form of sensation and the awareness or the space in which it arises and is present? And you might gently deepen the breath and let your eyes close, or if you like, you can remain with the eyes, either with the eyes closed or open. There's a two-part definition that I find helpful of meditation. One part is the practice of noticing what's happening while it's happening. This moment to moment to moment experience. The second part of this definition is the capacity to notice your relationship to what is happening. The gathering of your attention is critical in this practice. I like to think of attention as like light. It can be directed. You can take light and focus it through a magnifying glass, and you can burn a hole in a leaf. And you can stand in the open sunshine and you can feel the light just filling space everywhere. As Pat likes to say, you are developing yourself as a contemplative artist. You're building a repertoire of different techniques, different attentional strategies different ways of focusing your attention that will result in different ways. So it's been said that the byproduct of this practice is the arising of wisdom and compassion. The wisdom faculty is your capacity to recognize what's true, not your interpretation or your preference or your embellishment, but direct contact with what is actually here. And when you look closely at your moment-to-moment experience, the Buddha said you may notice three characteristics of reality. And it's important to point out that this is not a faith-based teaching. The Buddha admonished practitioners to verify this through your experience, to not believe it, but to verify it through your direct experience. And what I'd like to do is to talk about each of these, but also provide some space for inquiry. And hopefully you might be able to take this into your personal practice. So this first quality is anicca, or impermanence, the recognition of change. I was reflecting on this quality of change and how it permeates life. Recently, I've been asked to kind of perform or facilitate some weddings. I find it an honor to be asked. You know, there's something about weddings that's kind of bringing people together, and I enjoy sort of meeting different people, family members, and so forth. And I really come to recognize that I'm at the age now where most of the people my age are talking about, you know, their kids graduate from college or, you know, going into grad school, that sort of thing. And at a recent wedding with a couple in their late 20s, early 30s, I had this huge realization. There are a lot of people making babies out there. I was amazed. It seemed like there were just acres of fertile women and people talking about babies and with their babies. And it was just fascinating to see this whole strata of our culture that is just in that stage of life, of making it happen, raising their families. And then the contrast. 2 weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I was at a memorial service for my father. My dad was 89 when he died, and we had a memorial service at our Quaker meeting in Pennsylvania. And I met, kind of reconnected with a lot of people from the Quaker meeting who I hadn't seen for many, many years. And I walked around the corner and came right face to face with someone who I thought had died. And he almost said out loud, "I thought you were dead." So here was this whole strata of everyone on the way out. You know, someone said, "You have to meet my mom. She's like 99 years old, you know, sitting in a chair." There it is, impermanence. It reminded me of a story that someone said, how every time there'd be a family wedding, this woman said that she had this great aunt. At every wedding, her aunt would come over to her and say, "You're next." Every wedding. And as the years went by and she never got married, her aunt, great aunt would come over, "You're next." And it really started to bother her because it made her really, really self-conscious. But then she realized that the table was completely turned because the next family gathering was a funeral. So contemplating aging is a great way to come in contact with this law of impermanence. We often meet the fact of aging with sadness and grief and regret. There are some other things that are nice about getting older. I found that as I lose more hair, I'm saving a lot of money on shampoo. But beyond that, there have been many studies that show as you age, your happiness increases with age. I'd like to lead just a short reflection on the body and this fact of impermanence. So if you like, you can close your eyes again. This is a selection from a scientific article. Although people may think of their body as a fairly permanent structure, most of it is in a state of constant flux as old cells are discarded and new ones are generated in their place. Each kind of tissue has its own turnover time, depending in part on the workload endured by the cells. And you might just sense these different parts of the body. The cell linings in your stomach only last for 5 days. The red blood cells, bruised and battered after traveling nearly 1,000 miles through the maze of your body's circulatory system, last only 120 days or so on average before being dispatched to their graveyard in the spleen. The epidermis, or surface layer of the skin, is recycled every 2 weeks. The reason for this quick replacement is that the skin is the body's saran wrap. It's easily damaged by scratching, by solvents, by wear and tear. As for your liver, the detoxifier of all natural plant poisons and drugs that pass through your lips, its life on the chemical warfare front is quite short. An adult human liver probably has a turnover time of 300 to 500 days. Other tissues have lifetimes measured in years, but are still far from permanent. Your entire skeleton is thought to be replaced every 10 years. And about the only piece of the body that lasts a lifetime on present evidence seems to be the neurons of the cerebral cortex, the inner lens cell of the eye, and perhaps the muscle cells of the heart. And you might take a moment just to sense this inner world of constant change. And again, deepening your breath. If you like, you can open the eyes or feel free to remain with them closed. So the body is a wonderful thing to contemplate, to really come into an understanding of anicca. And Buddhist philosophy says that anything born out of causes and conditions is subject to change. So in our practice, how do you heighten your awareness of impermanence? How do you remember impermanence? And this is where concentration comes in as a very powerful tool. Concentration can become a wonderful doorway. The analogy that I find so helpful: imagine someone is asking you, what direction is the wind coming from and how fast is the wind? What you might do would be to focus your attention on, say, a church steeple or a branch. And once you've established your concentration there, you then widen your peripheral vision. And you'll find that in the foreground will be the branch or the church steeple. In the background will be this perception of the clouds, where they're coming from and how fast they're moving. And maybe you've noticed at times in your practice that you have established your anchor that you are firmly present to the breath or to the sounds or to the felt sense of the body, and you can simultaneously be aware of the background. Have you noticed that? The capacity to be present and at the same time the recognition of what's changing. There's something here about concentration, this moment-to-moment attention, but also this quality of relaxing back. An analogy that I find helpful for myself personally is kind of informed through yogic philosophy that speaks of the meditation practice as focus, establishing presence, flow, opening up to what's changing, and then letting go, just letting it be. And for the Sanskrit aficionados, that's dharana, dhyan, and samadhi. Focus, opening to flow, and the inquiry into letting go or surrender. In my own meditation practice, I have at times been stunned by this fact of impermanence. I remember on my first month-long retreat, as I was just trying to report out, I heard myself say, "It doesn't stop changing." And perhaps you've noticed this. Has any one meditation been the same as the one before? It's sometimes described as when you really stop and pay attention, it's like standing under a waterfall. Just this ongoing cascade of changing sensations, changing thought forms, changing moods, even different states of consciousness are in a constant process of change. And coming deeply to this understanding of impermanence can be enormously helpful. When you are struggling, to remember this too shall pass. This will change. Oftentimes I've found when I'm dealing with physical pain, with a migraine headache, at first glance it looks solid. But when I look deeply into the experience, in the pain, the physical pain, there's electrons moving around. It's shifting, it's changing, it's moving. I've also noticed in my practice that I've sort of sidestepped a lot of depression, because in the moments of feeling insight, of awakening, feeling like I've arrived, that it's here, those exalted moments, reminding myself this too will pass, is a powerful way of coming back to the wisdom, the recognition of what is here and its characteristic. So the second characteristic of reality is the recognition of dukkha. Many definitions of dukkha, dissatisfaction, unsteadiness, stress, suffering. I love the way the word dukkha sounds. And you've probably heard a meditation retreat is described by some people as dukkha, dukkha, dukkha lunch, dukkha, dukkha, dukkha dinner. And maybe your experience. Our experience of dukkha is in direct relationship to anicca, direct relationship to impermanence. And just as contemplating the body can lead to a very deep insight into the nature of anicca, contemplating the body, contemplating death can be a very powerful way of exploring our relationship to change. The last few years for me and for us has had a lot of death, a lot of change. My mother, my father, Tara's mother, her dog, our dogs in the last 3 years or so have all passed. I've been touched by those who've shared in the groups and the interviews of going through that process of letting go of a loved one. is heartbreaking. To watch my English professor father grasping for a sense of trying to keep a narrative alive with his dementia and his Alzheimer's, to watch the degradation of his memory, to no longer be recognized by him. He had access for some time to his sort of traumatic experiences in the war, in World War II, because they were kind of very searing memories, and then they fell away. And then he would talk about it, kind of the last thing I remember was him talking about being, as a young boy, going down to the plant where his father worked and walking back with his dad. And then those memories faded away. Watching a parent lose their story, lose their grasp, and to move into the tightness and the fear of trying to hold their life together. Helping a once bouncy and athletic dog to stand up and to lie down, to carry them outside. How do we hold that? How do we hold that fact that everyone you love, in no particular order, was going to fall away from their form? Whether it's by a gnashing of teeth or an ache of gratitude, we all have to let go. Another short inquiry, if you will. If you can close your eyes once again. As you just draw your attention into the breath, you might just take a moment to reflect on these past days of drawing yourself into presence. Just sensing what has changed. What have you seen? What have you felt? What has moved? What has shifted inside? Where has your struggle been? Your experience of dissatisfaction, of unsteadiness, of stress, of suffering. What have been your biggest struggles? Your greatest challenges? The basis of our practice is on the Four Noble Truths. The recognition that when you come into this form, suffering is part of the human experience. The recognition that there is a cause to suffering, and that it is related to identification, to attachment, to clinging. The recognition that the cessation of suffering is possible. It is possible to let go. And the recognition of the path, of the technologies, the teachings, the observations, the restraints that support the cessation of suffering. And again, deepening your breath. And if you like, letting the eyes open or remaining with them closed. So what is the science of letting go? How do we let go? I think it's helpful to look at how we don't let go. What are the signs of not letting go? It's helpful to reflect on the five hindrances, the five obstacles. Or as I sometimes describe when I'm teaching in a corporate setting, the five ways you react when things aren't going your way. How many of us here have experienced in the last 3 days some form of aversion? Anger, judgment, blame, ill will, hatred. Yeah. Has anyone here possibly experienced any of the flavors of craving, of planning, fantasy, getting lost in sense pleasure? Has anyone noticed yourself hijacked by worry, by anxiety, by restlessness, obsessive thinking, being on a hamster wheel? Yeah. Any sloth and torpor? Heaviness, sleepiness? Has anyone experienced any doubt or self-criticism? And now the next question. Has anyone experienced all five simultaneously? So there's good news and bad news here. As I like to say, the good news is there are only five. The bad news is they are quite pervasive. And yet there's something in the capacity of recognizing. As you relax and pay attention, inevitably you get onto yourself. You can more and more quickly recognize these states when they arise. And the fact that when you are identified with this state, they obscure presence. By recognizing them, sensing if you can allow, accept, make room for it, and to actively turn your attention to the phenomena itself. That is an integral part of letting go, of actively investigating what's arising in that moment. As Tara mentioned, pain times resistance equals suffering. As you continue and deepen your practice to recognize how resistance arises in these five states can be very, very helpful. The other aspect of exploring the letting go is the courage required to truly be intimate with your experience, to recognize, realize, if you can allow or accept, if it feels safe, and then to move deeply into investigation with a sense of kindness. I've often found for myself that where I feel that pain, the inability to let go, it's the willingness to deeply, deeply feel and acknowledge the ouch. Recognizing that, holding that in loving presence, that compassion is the lubrication that allows us to begin to let go. And in the letting go, it's so helpful to remember the N part of that equation, the non-identification, the shift in identity we feel when we move from holding something so tightly. Something has to shift. Einstein said that no problem was solved in the same consciousness that created it. To let go, somehow you have to shift your consciousness. Somehow there has to be some way of opening, of expanding, of finding refuge. A time of retreat is such a wonderful opportunity. I've just been touched again and again as I've talked with some of you on this retreat of the grief that is there, the sadness that is there. If it feels right, if it feels safe, this is a wonderful opportunity to actively explore what's between you and feeling free. This is a great time to grieve, feel and welcome it all, to let it get big, and to experiment what it's like to hold yourself with compassion, to hold yourself with empathy, to remind yourself that whatever you're feeling, other people feel that too, and to open into that space. Gibran talks about how as you encounter that grief, as you encounter sadness, he says, but if in your fear you would only seek love's peace and love's pleasure. Then it is better for you to cover your nakedness and pass into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all your laughter, and weep, but not all your tears. That calling, which I believe we all share to be fully alive, requires incredible courage to come in contact, to identify, to be with, and to embrace that which is not alive, that which is not yet alive. And Gibran goes on to say that when you love, you should not say, God is in my heart, but I am in the heart of God. However you translate that. Not presence is in my heart, but I am in the heart of presence. The third characteristic, anatta, or not self. Essentially, this is saying that there is no fixed self. As in anicca, if all things are born out of causes and conditions and are subject to change, what does that mean about what you call you? How much of you, what you call you, is the product of causes and conditions? The influence of your parents, the influence of your culture, all those are from causes and conditions. And rather than engage into a philosophical inquiry, and there are pages and pages and pages on this inquiry, what interests me is how can we open ourselves experientially into that inquiry? And I'd like to take the remainder of our time to explore that. And the teacher Adyashanti says, spiritual awakening is realizing what occupies the space called me. When you listen innocently, you'll see there is really something more here than a me. So how do we experience this? How are we touched by this? And again, I come back to the body and death. When we are with someone who passes, where do they go? A number of years ago, I was hiking with a friend, and I was hiking barefoot. This was in western Massachusetts in the summer, and I was stung by a bee. And I just kind of stopped and paused and pulled the stinger out, and we kept on walking. And as we were walking, I started to feel my scalp itchy, and my armpits started itching, and could feel my face sort of getting flush. And our hike kind of took us down to where there were a few people, and someone looked at me and said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm fine. And I just thought I'd hike back. It was about a mile back. And said, let me give you a ride. And by the time we arrived back from where I had started, I was starting to feel pretty flush. And someone noticed, and there was someone there who had actually been a medic in Vietnam. And he saw me and he said, get in the car. I was going into anaphylactic shock. And on the drive to the hospital, I started noticing a number of really interesting things. It was kind of a curious adventure. The time and space started getting very weird. At one point, as we were driving down Pittsfield, Massachusetts, I saw a woman on the corner, and her hand was just moving like this. And then I just glanced over at the speedometer, and we were going 90. I was very curious. And then I realized, I think I may be dying. I may be graduating early. And I remember at one point I thought, oh, I should do some mantra. I was living in an ashram at the time, and I said, oh, I guess I should do some mantra. So I started doing mantra, and then the pain got really bad. And I thought, well, screw that. I was going with what works, pragmatic dharma here. And by the time we got to the hospital, it was, I remember just aiming my hand for the handle of the door. I kind of fell out of the car, and I remember thinking to myself, why do we have to be so touchy-feely at the ashram? You know, why does he have to have his arm around me? And I realized, oh, I'm not walking. And I remember looking down from the ceiling at this body on the table and thinking, that is just a slab of meat, just a sort of objective observation. And I could hear people calling, you know, there were six people working on this body, and they were calling out, you know, someone was saying, I want those IVs wide open, and calling out blood pressure. And then I remember thinking, this is ridiculous. The only way they're going to bring this body back is if it's God's will. And then right then, it felt like I fell from the ceiling onto the table, and I heard a doctor's voice in my ear saying, he's back. We've got him. My experience after that was very interesting. I tried premature transcendence. That didn't work. I tried going right back to work. But I noticed that I could sort of imagine wherever I was without me in it. I was present, but I could sort of just see everything happening as if I wasn't there. And I also noticed at that time I was doing a lot of hands-on healing work. And I could just very objectively look at a body, see where the energy wasn't flowing, and do a few things. And people were like having these really powerful experiences. And I realized that I was present, but I was also disassociated at the same time. And I began to realize that I was sort of disconnected from compassion. It was just sort of pure awareness, but it felt so incomplete. And over time, as I started to bring more of a sense of empathy and compassion, it was a very, very powerful experience for me. Contemplating anatta, contemplating not self, is a tricky business. Because the mind, of course, wants to figure it out. But the directing the mind toward presence, toward openness, is in many ways a non-intellectual experience. So we can contemplate the self by reviewing what are called the aggregates, kind of these qualities that make up who you are. Your body. Are you your body? If your arm is amputated, are you less here? Maybe you're not your body. Sensation. The sensations that arise from form. Are you the sensations? Can you find you in the sensations? Perhaps not. The element of perception, that which perceives, is that you? Contemplating the mental formations, the stories, the beliefs that arise out of your experience. Can you find you in that? And even in consciousness, are you consciousness? Can you find you in consciousness? It becomes a very powerful inquiry to actively seek where you are, where the self is. How do we describe this? Here's what Lin Ji from the Zen tradition says. If you want to be free, get to know your real self. It has no form, no appearance, no root, no basis, no abode, but it is lively and buoyant. It responds with versatile facility, but its function cannot be located, Therefore, when you look for it, you become further from it. When you seek it, you turn away from it all the more. So if you look for it, you become further from it. Well, then what? And here's how another Zen practitioner's strategy worked out. Though I think not to think about it, I do think about it and shed tears thinking about it. This is elusive stuff. The classic saying you may have heard that enlightenment is an accident and meditation makes you accident prone. This quality is sometimes best described by what it's not. It's non-grasping. It's non-judging. It's non-manipulating. And when you think of the experience of what does it mean to not manipulate your experience, something opens up in that, and we'll explore that in a few minutes. Sometimes it's described as a quality of allowing, a quality of presence, a quality of being, a quality of openness, sometimes described as luminous, as infinitely compassionate. There are a number of ways how we can direct the mind to experience this state. One of them is the practice of inquiry, of simply asking, what am I? Or to choose a sense door, just for a moment, if you can bring your attention to sound. Just notice the listening. One form of listening is through the mind. The mind will identify the source, identify its location, identify its distance, and interpret whether it's of a threat or not. Another experience of listening is called bare attention, which is actually feeling the sound, experiencing the vibration of the sound. You might just take a moment, let your attention open to the sounds. And you might ask, who is listening right now? Contemplating the three characteristics. Contemplating anicca. Notice what is changing. And contemplating dukkha. Anything the mind fixates on will lead to a sense of dissatisfaction or unsteadiness. Anything you can let be will have a quality of ease. Contemplating anatta. Who is observing this experience? What are you? And relax into that question. The Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. When I was living in an ashram and had a celibacy vow, we had a saying, no relationship, no relationship problems. And when I had a poverty vow, we would say, no car, no car problems. And to quote a wonderful book, no self, no problem. This idea of no self, It can be terrifying, but it can also be freeing. One of my most favorite memories with Tara's mom at the end of her life, there's so much she loved, all the people in her life, her dogs. She also loved her convertible, her car, and she loved nature. Her last time being outside on an adventure, we put the top down in her car and loaded it up with her wheelchair and her oxygen tank and bundled her up in blankets, and I carried her out to her car. And I think she may not have weighed, you know, more than 90 pounds at that time. And as I carried her out, she repeatedly said, "Wee!" And that's been a mantra for me at times. When I and mine are not present, something arises which is quite magical, quite mysterious. So when we understand that all things are impermanent, all things have a quality of suffering, and all things are not self, and when we understand this not just on an intellectual level, but through consideration, contemplation, and meditation, then the fact, the recognition of impermanence, the fact and the recognition of suffering, and the fact and recognition of self and not self, they become part of our immediate experience. They inform our experience. Willful practice, developing concentration, a capacity for sustained moment-to-moment-to-moment attention, it's essential to this practice of waking up. Learning to recognize what is presenting, to open to it, to allow it, to have the courage to be intimate with it, to bring compassion, kindness to that. That is essential to waking up. And learning to relax, learning to let go, and learning how to surrender into your unfolding experience, that also is essential to the practice. As you enter into the belly of the retreat, it's a wonderful invitation to explore, to bring yourself present and again to relax back. So I'd like to close with a short meditation and a few readings I think you might enjoy. One wonderful way of opening attention to this quality of presence can be by turning your attention to the experience of sound and silence. And you might sense the details of the sounds around you. And can you sense the silence behind the sounds? Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. do not strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically again and again, time without end. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there. Open, inviting, and comfortable. Namaste.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.